This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Declaring acts of domestic terror have been committed by violent demonstrators, U.S. President Donald Trump vowed to end what he called the riots and lawlessness that has spread throughout the country. Mr. Trump said he was mobilizing all available federal resources, civilian and military, to stop the rioting and looting, to end the destruction and arson, and to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans, including Second Amendment rights. Just before the president spoke, reporters awaiting his remarks in the Rose Garden could hear loud explosions from volleys of tear gas fired around Lafayette Park, where riot police holding shields aloft pushed back peaceful demonstrators. Rubber bullets were also fired, and police on horseback were brought in to help clear the area. The movement of law enforcement came less than half an hour before a 7 p.m. curfew went into effect for Washington, D.C. The action cleared the way for the president clear the way, not for the smell of tear gas, around St. John's Church. It's a block north of the White House, to which Mr. Trump walked just minutes after the curfew went into effect. The historic Episcopal Church suffered minor damage Sunday evening when a small fire was set to its basement. In front of the boarded-up church, Mr. Trump held a Bible and referred to the United States as the greatest country in the world, saying we're going to keep it safe. Then Mr. Trump walked back to the White House surrounded by heavy security. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential candidate in a November election, was one of several who slammed the president for using the American military against the American people after the president vowed to order an army crackdown on the sweeping civil unrest. This is VOA News. Washington's mayor, Muriel Bowser, is calling President Trump's actions shameful, going on to say that a full 25 minutes before a curfew of without provocation, federal police used munitions on peaceful protesters in front of the White House, an act that will make the job of the D.C. Police Department more difficult. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo also expressed outrage over the incident. He said what the president did was he called out the American military against American citizens. A Minneapolis medical examiner has classified George Floyd's death as a homicide, saying his heart stopped as police restrained him and compressed his neck. The medical examiner's report also lists heart disease and hypertension as other significant conditions, along with fentanyl intoxication and recent methamphetamine use. A widely seen video that shows Floyd struggling with a police officer holding his knee on his neck has sparked the national outrage and protest. Floyd's family said Monday that its independent autopsy found Floyd died by asphyxiation, and their attorney called for charges against the police officer to be upgraded to first-degree murder. An Illinois man who allegedly said that he was traveling to Minneapolis to riot after the death of George Floyd has been charged on federal counts. The 28-year-old Matthew Lee Rupert is charged with civil disorder, rioting, and possession of unregistered destructive devices. An FBI affidavit says that Rupert posted videos to his Facebook page last week that showed him in Minneapolis handing out explosives to others. More than 375,000 deaths resulting from COVID-19 have been recorded globally, more than 105,000 in the United States. The number of worldwide infections is well above 6.2 million and above 1.8 million in the U.S. South Korea is testing a new quick response code system this week to log visitors at high-risk entertainment facilities, restaurants, and churches in a bid to track coronavirus cases and prevent further spread of the disease. The decision to mandate QR codes to register visitors' identities came after authorities struggled to trace people who had visited a number of nightclubs and bars at the center of the virus outbreak last month, after much of the information on handwritten visitor logs was found to be false or incomplete. Starting June 10th, visitors to nightclubs, bars, karaoke clubs, daytime discos, indoor gyms, and more will be required to use any of a number of commercially available apps to generate a one-time personalized QR code that can be scanned at the door. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya commemorates Day of Self-Rule amid COVID-19 pandemic.
I am further comforted by the teachings of our founding fathers to be our very best at our darkest moment. I appreciate, and on behalf of an eternally grateful nation, to recognize and commend our healthcare workers for giving their all in support of our response to this pandemic.
Uganda's president eases some coronavirus lockdown measures. Ghanaians study herbal cures for coronavirus. Lawyers for two detained Ugandan parliamentarians call for their release. And political violence is on the rise in Malawi as that country prepares for presidential election rerun.
If the leaders are not responsible in their sentiments, in their undertaking, definitely followers will do the same. So to me, it's not a strange thing. This has been there on the podium, and what we see today is the result of what has been happening.
Many manifestations of African beliefs at French museums. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta led Kenyans in marking the 57th Madaraka Day celebrations at State House in Nairobi yesterday, Monday. This was due to COVID-19 pandemic, which called for social distances. Hence, few political and church leaders were invited. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the COVID-19 situation is worsening in Kenya on a daily basis.
Kenya marked 57 years of independence in unusual celebration that took place in State House, Nairobi. On normal days, political leaders within and outside Africa always attend the public celebrations that take place in public areas attended by Kenyans. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, acknowledging the fact that COVID-19 has led to hard economic times and even loss of jobs, as more than 287,000 Kenyans lost jobs between January and March this year, as numbers increase in the months of April and May, President Kenyatta may consider easing some of the put-up restrictions to fight COVID-19 in order to revive the economy.
Although slowed down by the health crisis and the economic downturn caused by COVID-19, I am further comforted by the teachings of our founding fathers. They instructed us to be our very best at our darkest moment. I appreciate, and on behalf of an eternally grateful nation, to recognize and commend our healthcare workers for giving their all in support of our response to this pandemic.
As the country struggles and more money is needed to be pumped into the economy, President Kenyatta wants a referendum held to change the 2010 constitution that he says does not accommodate all Kenyans.
I am already discerning a constitutional moment, and I want to be clear, not a moment to replace the 2010 constitution, but one to improve on it. A moment that will right what we didn't get correct in 2010. But fundamentally, the constitutional moment that I discern is one that will bring an end to the senseless cycles of violence that we have experienced in every election cycle since 1992. And one that will deepen our democratic credentials as a country.
On the other hand, Deputy President William Ruto urged leaders and Kenyans to work together with the government to mitigate the effects of COVID-19.
Every Kenyan across this nation is now part of the big army to try and deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm calling on leaders across the divide and Kenyans across the nation to work with you and government to make sure that we mitigate and minimize the effects of this pandemic as we work out the new normal.
Even though the government wants to ease the restrictions put in place to combat COVID-19, the number of COVID-19 cases continue to rise. As yesterday, Monday, 59 more people tested positive for COVID-19, raising the number to 2,021. Five more people died, bringing the death toll to 69, as 482 recovered from the disease. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Uganda has moved a step further in easing the lockdown brought about as a measure to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 by allowing public transport to start operating. However, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni postponed partial opening of schools that was expected this week because the government says it cannot manage to test both students and staff returning back to school. Mugumi Davis Rakariji reports from Kampala.
In his address to the nation this Monday evening, President Museveni said he was advised by health experts against allowing school children to return back to school at least for another month.
This is because there are still many risks. The different category refineries are a total of 1.4 million children and students who do not yet have enough testing kits for testing those numbers every 2 weeks to know who is carrying the virus and who is not if they are asymptomatic, if they do not show signs. We have the machines for testing. The problem is the reagents. Even if we could test all the finalists, there would still be the issue of the day scholars that oscillate between the schools and the homes every day.
He said the government is working on a more reliable means of distance learning for students. Last month, the president started easing the lockdown by opening up restaurants, garages, and workshops for artisans, as well as private means of transport carrying passengers at half the capacity.
We shall now allow the regulated opening of the public bus means of transport, such as the minibuses, buses, taxis, provided they carry only one half of their normal capacity, plus the conductor and the driver. We hope this can enable public transport to travel again without the usual overcrowding, which is very dangerous during such times as this.
President Museveni has usually encouraged Ugandans to use bicycles as a sport and the safest means of travel. Motorcycle taxis, locally known as border boarders, are not allowed to carry passengers. Also, over 40 districts that are located along Uganda's international borders will not be allowed to use either public or private transport for fear people across the borders may access them. Despite calls by religious leaders, places of worship will remain closed, so as political, cultural, and sports gatherings. But the president also added on some more business categories start opening.
Shopping malls are joined but spacious, unlike the arcades, which are numerous and congested. Starting with the 4th of June 2020, therefore, the shopping malls will be allowed to open, provided they observe social distancing. The experts think that they have enough space for social distancing.
The president said the distribution of free masks by the government will commence next week. He also said the government will resume supplying food to the very vulnerable people so they can cope with the lockdown. The curfew in the rest of the country, which starts at 7 p.m., 6:30 a.m., stays. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Uganda, defense lawyers for two arrested opposition parliamentarians say they plan to go to the Gulu Central Police Station today, Tuesday, where two MPs are being detained to seek their release. Their decision followed a condemnation by human rights activists and lawyers who say the arrest of the lawmakers is politically motivated and yet another move by President Yoweri Museveni to intimidate and harass the opposition. But supporters of the ruling party say the lawmakers violated a presidential directive intended to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Conrad Obo Oroya is the lead attorney for Gilbert Olaya and Samuel Odondo Otto. He says his clients were calling for the closure of the border separating Uganda from neighboring South Sudan.
They've not been released. Efforts to get them out have been very futile, so they're in police custody.
So what are they being accused of?
They have been accused of two counts of charges. Firstly, that they're inciting the public, inciting of violence. And then two, that they negligently behaved in a way that they intended to cause infection of disease. So those are the two counts of charges preferred, pending sanctioning by the prosecutor. What I heard from the corridors of the prosecutor's office is that I think they're going to drop the second count and just go with excitement and violence.
But why were they not released? I understand you were there. You were part of the team that went to try to secure their release or perhaps bail. Why were they not released? Take me through the process briefly.
I think it's like I said, this is one of those unfortunate cases where people just go to police and they never come out because of, I think, the political interest. Because in our opinion, we thought we did all it could. We made sure that they took their statements are recorded, and then so that they could now get born as a right. Immediately thereafter, the file was moved to the office of the prosecutor for their opinion to advise the police on next steps, which file took extraordinarily too long. When it came back close to 5 of business of the day, and when it came back, issues were very strong for us. Firstly, that the evidence or statement recorded were very insufficient to even sustain a charge. And then the prosecutor referred the police to do extra investigation to make the file complete for sanctioning. And then we expected, then the next step is, because they can't be there when investigation is incomplete. But unfortunately, the DPC, the investigation team from police, told us we cannot release until we consult the powers that be. And so questioning, what powers that be do you want? Your advisor is the prosecutor. We spent a couple of hours, and before we realized the missing piece of evidence that they said the prosecutor needed, that they have pictures of them holding the placards with writings, and that's what they're going to present tomorrow to the prosecutor for a second opinion.
Conrad, let me ask you, will you and your team go there on Tuesday to try to secure their release again?
We will go back tomorrow early morning to the prosecutor's office, and once their file is ready, if they want to take the court, we are ready for trial tomorrow, especially for the pretrial relief of bail. If it's not ready, we'll again engage them that they be released on police bond, because then hours are running. After tomorrow, we would have clocked the mandatory, you know, remand period that the law prescribes. So we're going to go back tomorrow early morning and do all we could to see that if it's court, then we're ready, the sureties are ready. If it's police bond, we are equally ready.
Conrad Obo-Oroya is the lead attorney for 2 detained Ugandan members of parliament. You're speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 2nd. Political violence is on the rise in Malawi as the country prepares for a rerun of last year's presidential election, which was nullified over alleged fraud. The victims are mostly opposition party members beaten by suspected supporters of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP. Political analysts say the increase in violence needs to be addressed to avoid the street clashes seen in last year's election. Lamech Masina reports from Blantyre.
Bernard Sande, regional governor for the opposition United Transformation Movement in eastern Malawi, says he was driving to a political rally 2 weeks ago when a group of people blocked his car and pulled him out of the vehicle. Sande says he believes they were members of the ruling DPP. He spoke to VOA via telephone. He says they ordered me to remove my party T-shirt and they started beating me up left, right and center. I tried to plead with them that we had nothing against them, but they could not listen. It was not one person. There were about 3 or 4 fighting me alone. Sunday is one of several victims of political violence ahead of fresh presidential polls on June 23. 3 candidates are expected to contest the race, but the main challenge will be between Lazarus Chakwera, leader of the opposition Tonse Alliance, and President Peter Mutharika, leader of the DPP, who has made an alliance with the opposition United Democratic Front. The political tension escalated into street clashes over the weekend. On Saturday, police used tear gas to disperse suspected opposition party supporters who bent tires to block a convoy of Mutharika's running mate at Pele Muluzi in Dowa District in central Malawi. The incident came a day after suspected DPP supporters attacked a convoy of Chakwera's running mate, Saulos Chilima, in southern Malawi, where a vehicle carrying media had its windows smashed, injuring several journalists. The worst incident so far was the fuel bombing of the opposition UTM office in Lilongwe in LMA, in which 3 occupants died and 3 others left with severe burns. No one has been arrested in connection with the incident. Political analyst Sherif Gaisi says the violence was to be expected because of incitement from political leaders. He spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
If the leaders are not responsible in their sentiments, in their undertakings, definitely followers will do the same. So to me, it's not a strange thing. This has been there on the podium, and what we see today is the result of what has been happening.
Political leaders deny responsibility for orchestrating those attacks, instead blaming one another. At a press conference Saturday, Muluzi said the leaders of the opposition alliance are mobilizing youths to attack him. Chilima denied this and instead said he has evidence that President Mutharika and former President Bagiri Muluzi, Atupele's father, are orchestrating the violence with the goal of assassinating him. Chilima, who is also Malawi's vice president, said he and his lawyers will take the matter to the International Criminal Court. Political analyst Kaisi says the candidates should be talking, not filing lawsuits.
There is justice in the court of laws, but in many cases, typical political issues are not dealt with properly by the court, but by the politicians themselves.
In the meantime, a quasi-religious body, Public Affairs Committee, says it is planning a meeting with political leaders this week to find a lasting solution to the ongoing violence. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
In Malawi, a new poll conducted by the Institute of Public and Research, the IPOR, shows that a majority of the population is unafraid of the coronavirus. The findings of the survey, however, show respondents are more concerned about hunger than the disease. Dr. Boniface Dulani, a senior partner at the IPOR, says many Malawians express concern about the effect of hunger more than the impact of COVID-19. Malawian health authorities have so far confirmed 280 people infected with the virus, with 4 deaths and 42 recovered. Dr. Dulani, who is also a senior political science lecturer at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that there appears to be a lot of doubt about the coronavirus in the country.
Well, we find that the Malawians actually express less fear of COVID-19 as much as they express more fear of the impact of COVID-19, especially in terms of hunger, loss of access to healthcare, as well as the likely stigma that they will face if they are found with the coronavirus.
I understand some people don't even believe that the coronavirus exists in Malawi. Was this reflected in your finding?
Well, we find actually that many Malawians, almost 99%, say that they've heard of COVID-19. The knowledge and awareness levels are quite high. Of course, there is a skepticism about the numbers of confirmed COVID-19 cases. At the moment, we have just slightly under 300 cases in the country. There are quite some people who feel that the number is actually not a true reflection. It's on the higher side, while others think that the number is actually underreported because of low numbers of testing.
Well, Dr. Boniface, I heard some people saying that the fear of hunger more than the coronavirus perhaps could be that people do not believe the sensitization going on about the disease and what it can do to people. Did this show in the findings?
It does in part. I think there is concern, of course, among Malawians that perhaps politicians are trying to use coronavirus as, again, just one avenue to extract public resources corruptly. So a lot of people express this skepticism, not because they think that coronavirus doesn't exist, but that if there are resources available to fight coronavirus, they will not trickle down to the ordinary masses who who most of them in the Malani case live day to day by earning money, you know, in the markets and then buying their food for the day. So that is really the main source of this fear. And of course, which is about just 4 people dying from coronavirus. I guess there are also people who think that they can take their chances and maybe they will survive the virus, but they will not survive the hunger.
What are the major takeaways of this survey, and what can policymakers take away from this in terms of coming up with new policies or amending old ones in order to improve the living conditions of Malawians during this pandemic?
I think it's important that if the messaging on coronavirus is going to be listened to and acted on by the ordinary citizens, government needs to adopt a much more holistic approach to fighting the virus. We have had a government here in Malawi that has tried to impose a lockdown that was fiercely resisted. We had citizens basically going on impromptu demonstrations on the streets complaining that you cannot just impose a lockdown without providing safety net measures in terms of food, cash, people who earn a daily living in the markets, and so on and so forth. So if we just look at the coronavirus just from a purely epidemiological point of view, we run the risk of not succeeding in fighting this coronavirus among poor citizens across Africa.
Dr. Boniface Dulani is a senior partner at the Institute of Public and Research of Malawi. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotier from the capital, Lilongwe. Since the COVID-19 outbreak, Ghanaians have traveled to a plant research center outside the capital, Accra, to give scientists and researchers herbal products and plants that they think will help cure the coronavirus or at least alleviate the symptoms. About 70% of Ghanaians depend on herbal remedies for their health care. Last year, government hospitals began integrating the practitioners and training them to incorporate scientific methods into their work. Stacy Knott reports from Akuapen Mapong.
The Center for Plant Medicine Research grew out of a visit by a Ghanaian doctor to China in the 1960s to learn from Chinese herbal medicine. The center's acting executive director, Kofi Bobby Barama, dreams of finding a cure for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus that came from China. And he's not the only one. Some people come to the center located in a lush, mountainous area in Ghana's eastern region, claiming they have a cure for the virus revealed to them in a dream.
What we've told them is that it's good that has been revealed to you, but at the Center for Plant Medicine Research, what we do is that we do research to look at the safety of it and then also to make sure that it's something that can be consumed by the public, and we also make sure that it's something that is plant-based.
In the labs of the center, researchers have been testing local herbal products to see what might help in Ghana's fight against COVID-19. So far, they have recommended herbal products to boost immunity. But the center is also testing and planning trials of herbal medicines against the virus, scientist Alfred Mpoma Apia says.
Herbs have what we call phytonutrients or phytoconstituents. And when we use these herbs, they have a broad activity that helps the whole. It contributes to health a lot.
Ghanaians' belief in traditional plant-based medicine is widespread. The center grows medicinal plants to help with a range of diseases and conditions, including malaria, typhoid, and high blood pressure, Michael Ofori, a technologist at the center, says.
Our forefathers were using these herbs long before we were born, but they didn't have the scientific means to research and know the actual dosage of the plants. Now we are being privileged to have that technology at hand. So then we have to then attach that technology to the herbal aspects that can be very safe for us to consume.
In a town close to the centre, trader Abena Oye says she relies on herbal remedies and hopes Ghana will find a traditional cure for COVID-19. She says it would make them happy because the illness is something that is worrying us. All our finances are messed up, says Oye. The whole world is a mess. So if the medicine comes, she says, we will be very happy and we will take it and it will help us and Ghana will be held in high esteem. That is also the ultimate goal of Ghana's Center for Plant Medicine Research. But any treatment, they say, must rely on scientific evidence, not just dreams. Stacey Knott for VOA News. Akuapim Mampong, Ghana.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a beautiful day.